Hi, it's Leah. Today I'm speaking with Tom Khalil. Tom is Chief Innovation Officer at Schmidt Futures, where he leads projects to harness technology for social impact, improve science policy, and identify and pursue 21st century moonshots. Tom has previously spent more than a decade in the White House, helping to design and launch national science and technology initiatives in areas such as nanotech, data science, commercial space, and many more. Although I had about 100 more questions to ask Tom, we cover lots of ground, from how to build moonshot cultures to the role of the generalist and the relationship between tech and policy. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Tom. So Tom, thanks so much for being here today. Perhaps to start off, what makes someone a policy entrepreneur?
Yeah, policy entrepreneur is someone who identifies an opportunity to improve public policy and then actually works to make it happen. So if you think about the analogy to an entrepreneur in the private sector, it's someone who's identified an unmet need in terms of products and services and then is creating a company to actually develop and produce that product or service. By analogy, the policy entrepreneur is someone who is identifying an unmet need in terms of public policy and then is actually working to make it happen.
Got it. So if we then define your field as that of policy entrepreneurship, what to you is the most fascinating idea in your field?
The most fascinating idea. So I'm biased. One of the things that I've been interested in for a while is the idea of moonshots or grand challenges. That is, in the same way that President Kennedy said, let's put astronauts on the moon and have them safely return by the end of the decade. And we decided as a country that we wanted to sequence the human genome and not only do that, but drive the cost of that down from $100 million to $1,000. What are the similarly ambitious goals that we should be trying to set in the 21st century?
Yeah, I definitely want to come back to moonshots later. It seems like to get anything done in the political realm, tacit knowledge is critical. So to develop strong relationships, you have to understand the complex social dynamics of an organization, the personalities of senior leadership, and so on. But you seem to care greatly about mentorship and teaching others about what you learned. So when educating someone, what are the flavors of situations that you try to expose them to in order to get up to speed? What are the most effective ways you've found to transmit tacit knowledge?
Yeah, it definitely requires or certainly benefits from experiential learning. So I think there's a certain amount that you can learn by reading and by asking someone questions, but I don't think there's any alternative. There's no real viable alternative to actually doing it. So I'll give you an example. So from as context, from 2001 to 2008, I was at UC Berkeley. And I started a program called Big Ideas at Berkeley. And the premise of the program was students have ideas of their own and that they're intrinsically motivated to work on and that the campus should be trying to support those. One group of students had created the Berkeley chapter of an organization called Universities Allied for Essential Medicines. And they were interested in changing intellectual property policy on the campus as a way of expanding access to essential medicines in low-income countries. And they had written a letter to the chancellor and a month had gone by and they hadn't gotten a response. And so they came to me and they said, Tom, what should we do? And I said, you should write the response that you want the chancellor to send back. And they looked at me quizzically because it seemed sketchy to them and that they shouldn't be allowed to do that. But they did that. And then I told them who would need to approve it. So they negotiated the text of the letter with that person. And then they were the only chapter of this national organization that had this very strongly worded letter from the chancellor on their issue. You can tell someone the general maxim, which is if you want someone to do something, make it as easy as possible. But I think it's far more powerful to put them in a situation where they actually see the value of using that approach.
Yeah, for sure. Nothing replaces, in the end, being in the field. So I always find it very interesting to think about the distinction between the private and the public sector. The relationship between tech and politics is often communicated to be an adverse one. And sometimes they indeed seem to be in somewhat of a race, since technology is a powerful agent for positive change, but it's also destabilizing of pre-existing power. So how do you think about the relationship between technology and the government? And how has your thinking maybe on this also evolved?
Yeah, no, good question. One thing that I'm interested in, there are definitely some areas where there's a growing level of tension. And so, for example, you can see that in concerns about the market of large tech companies and whether there needs to be more rigorous enforcement of antitrust policy or whether we need some sort of more robust and comprehensive policy and legal framework for issues around privacy. But another set of issues that I'm interested in is the ability to combine the types of problems that the public sector is focused on with some of the abilities that the private sector has. For example, the ability to move more rapidly, continuous improvement, the ability to scale things. And I think a lot of times the public sector is working on some more important problems than fine-tuning the like button on Facebook. So an example would be in the United States alone, we have 36 million adults who are reading at the third grade level or below. That is not a problem that the private sector is focused on. It's something that the public sector is trying to address. I would like to have my cake and eat it too, have the really important problems that the public sector is trying to tackle with the creativity and scale and ability to continuously improve that we see in the private sector.
And how do you get them closer to one another then and working together perhaps even more effectively?
One example that I'd like to give is the collaboration between NASA and SpaceX. So the context for this is that the United States retired the space shuttle because we could no longer guarantee its safety. So every time the United States wanted to send an astronaut to the International Space Station, we had to write the Russians a very large check to send the astronauts up to the space station on the Soyuz rocket. And so NASA decided that they wanted to partner with the private sector. So they told the private sector, we want a rocket that will go up to the International Space Station, start off by delivering and retrieving cargo, and then ultimately astronauts. So we're going to tell you what we want, but we're not going to tell you how to do it. And not only will we buy rides on your rocket once you have it, but we will also provide you with what are called milestone payments for intermediate progress towards that goal. So NASA got a capability for a fraction of the cost that it would have cost them had they used a business as usual approach, because they didn't have to pay the whole thing. Like SpaceX was motivated to go out and raise capital and work on this on their own dime. And the United States went from having essentially zero market share to being a dominant player in the global market for launch services. So that's a model that I think is really powerful.
Yeah. And we touched upon it briefly already, but perhaps to summarize, what tend to be the characteristics of those functions that lend themselves to private solutions?
Yeah, economists have this concept of market failures, which I think is useful for thinking about the answer to your question. The private sector doesn't do a very good job of providing public goods. So public goods are things that are non-rival and non-excludable. National security and defense is a good example. When the United States provides national security, they can't say, we're going to provide it to everyone except for Leah. Everyone gets it. Or basic research. It's something that benefits everyone. It doesn't disproportionately benefit the company that invests in basic research. And then externalities. When I make a decision about whether I should get electric appliances or appliances that use natural gas, I'm not including in that decision the social cost of carbon. So it's not just a transaction between two mutually consenting adults. It's a transaction that has an impact on the welfare of others that is not included in the price. So public goods and positive and negative externalities are some examples of where the market is not going to lead to the optimal solution. You also just have instances where the efficient allocation of resources is not the only goal that we have. So for example, we have rough consensus in the United States that if you're a child living in a poor family, we still care about your wealth. So we're not going to say, if you happen to have poor parents, we don't really care about the fact that you're going to go to bed hungry every night. And I think that's the other situation, is where we have values like every human life is of equal value that are not necessarily are things that can be driven by the market.
So if you could pull any lever and change any, let's say, one to three things that speed up the future, what would you do?
So one we talked about, which was this idea of a more systematic effort to identify and pursue 21st century moonshots. A second is more experimentation with different ways of supporting research and innovation. I've been working with Adam Marblestone, for example, this idea of focused research organizations. And we don't know whether it will work, but it seems plausible that there's a class of problems that would benefit from the existence of university-adjacent, time-bound research nonprofits that can pursue projects that you can't do in a startup because there's no short-term path to profitability. And it's very difficult to do in an academic environment because it requires a higher level of team science or systems. So the idea that we should have a pipeline of those types of ideas where we're experimenting with some new model for how we fund and organize research and innovation, I think is another thing that I'm convinced makes a lot of sense. And then finally, economists make the distinction between push and pull approaches to innovation. So push is, Leah, you're a university researcher, I'm the government, and I give you a grant to pursue a particular research project, and I hope that you make progress on the research question that you've identified in the grant. And that's the primary way in which the government supports research. During the course of my career, I've been involved in increasing the capacity of the government to use other approaches. So for example, when I worked for President Clinton, I was able to help DARPA get prize authority, which they used for the self-driving car competition. So there, the government wasn't funding research in self-driving cars. It was saying, hey, we're going to give an incentive prize to whichever team can build a self-driving vehicle that can successfully navigate this obstacle course. Michael Kramer, who recently won the Nobel Prize in economics, came up with an idea called advanced market commitments. So this is a purchase order for a product that doesn't exist yet. And as a result of his work, five countries and the Gates Foundation worked with the pharmaceutical industries to create an AMC for a vaccine for diseases. So basically they said to the private sector, we will bear the demand risk if you bear the performance risk. If you develop a vaccine which is safe and effective, then we commit up front that we will provide a copay of $7 a dose for this many million doses. And that one decision saved the lives of 700,000 poor kids in developing countries. So what I would like to see is a marketplace for outcomes where you have three types of participants. One is the sponsor, that is the entity like the government or maybe a philanthropist who is willing to pay for the outcome. The second is the teams that they can believe that they can achieve the outcome. And the third is investors or philanthropists who might be backing individual team members that they've done due diligence on.
Yeah. To quote you in one of your papers, you said the intellectually honest answer to most questions about politics and policy is either it depends or I'm not sure. In light of common disincentives against admitting limitations to what can be made explicit, saying I don't know, how often do you think people pretend to be able to concretize more than the required epistemic humility would justify?
I think if someone asks me a general question and it has to do with the behavior of individuals and institutions and organizations, it's unlikely that there's something like the law of gravity or something like that, that is a universal answer to that question. And I think instead, what people have a tendency to do is to say, I was in a situation similar to that, and I took this particular action, and it worked, or it didn't work. And therefore, I'm going to generalize and say that the right answer is X. And I think that's where people might get into trouble, is they will extrapolate from their own personal experience, and everyone is guilty of doing this. And rather than saying, okay, well, in a situation where this is the particular context, you might want to try this, and here's why, as opposed to saying the right answer is always X, because there is no equivalent of F equals MA in politics and policy and things like that.
Yeah, the social sphere is inherently irreducible to laws like that. There's often, in certain circles at least, kind of a negative perception of going into public office. And that might also be largely influenced by the media. What would you change about the messaging about working in public office? And what are common misconceptions about your field?
I think one is that there's a sense that because in a lot of issues, we have divided government or partisan gridlock, and therefore there are many important things that are not happening. Infrastructure Week has become like a running joke, although who knows, Infrastructure Week might finally arrive. And so I think people infer from that that nothing is happening. And this would be like if your perception of New York City was based solely on reading the crime pages. It's not that that information is inaccurate. It just might be misleading if you were trying to get a picture of what it's like to live in New York and you didn't read what was going on in arts and culture in that particular week, for example. And so I think there's a lot of things that are going on that can occur even if on some really important issues like immigration, you have a lack of agreement about how to proceed by the two parties and no one party is in a position to just ram through their agenda. So for example, when I worked for President Clinton, I was able to convince him to go to Caltech and give a speech launching the National Nanotechnology Initiative. And that's resulted in over $30 billion of investment in nanoscale science and engineering, dozens of countries copying the United States and launching something similar, lots of universities creating research initiatives in this area. I was talking to one MIT faculty member who said, if you look at the kind of young faculty, that he believes that roughly half of them have some dimension of their research that relates to nanoscale science at this point. And that didn't require legislation. It was launched in January of 2000. Congress ultimately did pass a law that went along with it. But in order to get it started, it didn't require authorization legislation. So I think people are not always attuned to the fact that even when on some very important issues, which ideally we would be making progress on, like immigration, for example, it's still possible to do things that A, are significant, and B, from the point of view of the person who worked with lots of other people in the federal government to make them happen, were rewarding. I thought that was like time well spent for me to spend some of my time when I was working for President Clinton to learn about the field of nanoscale science and engineering, be able to communicate why the federal government should invest, get the relevant science agencies to work together to support it, and ultimately get the president and the Congress to back it as well.
So going back to moonshots, there seems to be some nostalgia for the national excitement about science and tech that kind of was encompassed in, like you mentioned, the era of the moon landing. And it does seem, to me at least, weaker today. So how do we, again, unite behind a collective vision of ambitious efforts and create a culture of moonshot thinking? And as one potential gateway, how do we change culture to view the moonshot enablers as the heroes?
Yeah, so I think that the media and storytellers could play an important role here. So I like this observation from Dean Kamen, who was involved in starting the first robotics competition and has been a serial inventor and an entrepreneur. And he said, in a free society, you get what you celebrate. If we celebrate Instagram influencers, then we're going to get more of those. But if we would celebrate teams that are working on really hard and important problems, that might motivate more young people to pursue that as their career. I think that's one thing. I think it's an open question to me about whether some of the things that we've done in the past, like the World's Fair, whether those would work in today's media environment. But I think those types of things are definitely worth thinking about. I think it's worth noting that the leadership of New York City approached Salk and said, hey, we're willing to do a ticker tape parade. And he turned it down. I think it would have been nice to do something like that for the developers of the mRNA vaccines.
So you've posed a list of interesting questions in the past, and I'm going to pose one back to you. How might we more systematically identify ambitious goals where recent scientific and technological advances have made the formerly impossible possible? How might we expose leaders to these ideas and inspire them to embrace at least one? And this is, I suppose, my add-on. Is the information asymmetry the central bottleneck to having more cool billionaires, as in people willing to fund projects, but not necessarily having the time and context to find out what's possible?
Yeah, let me answer that question first. I think they need to find someone they can trust who is then in this role of trying to create a good match between the interests of a given philanthropist and some of the ideas that are bubbling up from the research community. So that's, I think in the absence of that, they face too many choices. And sometimes the fact that there are so many choices leads to paralysis in terms of their ability to make a decision. With respect to the first part of the question, clearly one way to do this is to say, what are the problems that we face? So for example, various people have looked at the problem of climate change and then tried to decompose that problem so that you can begin to identify specific goals and then say, okay, like, has anything changed about our ability to solve this particular problem? In the community that I hang out with, there's growing interest in geothermal because it turns out that if you can dig a hole that is deep enough, you could get geothermal everywhere, not just in particular places in the earth. And people have ideas for how you could economically dig a hole that is 10 kilometers down or something like that. So I think that's one thing, is you can start with the problem and try to decompose the problem. I think the other thing that we need to do a better job of is combinatorial innovation. And what I mean by that is a lot of times innovation is the combination of existing building blocks, combining chocolate and peanut butter to make Reese's cups. And why is that hard? It's because in many instances, the way we train researchers is for them to be hyper-specialized. So we're generating so much knowledge that they think that the only way to be at the frontier of human knowledge about ourselves or the world around us is to have not just a discipline, but like a sub-discipline. So for example, there are two conferences about the role of iron in human nutrition, and one is about iron deficiency and another one is about too much iron. And hardly anyone goes to both of those conferences. You either go to one or the other. And so as a result, it's difficult for any one person to say, what are the different scientific and technological building blocks, which if we put them together in a novel way would allow us to solve a problem that was previously we couldn't solve. So I think that's something that we need to work on, is how do we make it easy for people to at least, even if they don't have detailed knowledge about any one particular technique, to at least have a sense for what its capability is now and how it's likely to improve over the future. And then that might give them new insights into combining various tools for solving problems and making progress in different areas for research and innovation.
And have you seen any promising ideas to maybe counteract that hyper-specialization? Because to me, it seems like a really big problem as well. And if you talk to anyone in the scientific community, they themselves don't always seem to be the biggest fans of it, but it seems almost inevitable based on some misaligned incentives, perhaps, to go into this hyper-specialization.
Yeah, so I think we have to recognize that there is a role for the generalist who will have the ability to look across different fields and see, again, this idea of kind of novel combinations of existing scientific and technological building blocks. So I think naming that role, explaining why it's important, and having mechanisms for supporting it is something that is very useful.
Got it. You've been described as a case of someone in the White House with a rare long-term view. How can we encourage, in your view, more long-termism? And how can we as a society develop mechanisms for pursuing goals that may not pay off for decades?
Let me tell you one of the more interesting ideas that I came across when I was working for President Obama, which was being pursued by some researchers at NASA. One in particular, his name was, I believe, Phil Metzger. And he and his colleagues wrote a paper called Bootstrapping a Solar System Civilization. And the long-term vision was, what if everything that we used in space came from space? The status quo is everything that we want to use in space comes from Earth, and it's like very expensive to get it into space. And if we could do that, then we could extend the sphere of human civilization out into the solar system and be able to take advantage of all the resources and energy that exists in space and do, you know, some pretty remarkable things. So an example would be a telescope that is so large, it wouldn't be one monolithic telescope, it would be an array that exists over a large area, but it would be capable of seeing the object the size of a Honda Civic on a planet operating around another star. That's the type of thing that humanity could think about doing if we had access to all the resources that exist in space. And so their view was, well, you don't want to have to ship everything into space. And so what you'd like to be able to do is have machines that make machines or self-replicating robotic factories. Now, even if that is your long-term vision, it's not something you're going to do tomorrow. I think you have to have a story about how, okay, this is our long-term vision, right? We want to extend the sphere of human activity and human civilization out into the solar system, but we're not going to, by 2022, have a closed loop self-replicating robotic factory. What we probably need to start off with is like oxygen. So how would we find ice and then be able to take the water from the ice and use that for, you know, oxygen and hydrogen? What are, even if we have a long-term vision, what are the intermediate steps towards that goal that make us feel like we're making progress? Because I think it's very difficult to, it's probably the wrong strategy, but I think it's also difficult to keep people engaged if you're saying, okay, we're going to work on this and we're not going to have anything to show for it for 100 years. And so I think this goal of identifying intermediate milestones is important for being able to set these longer term goals.
Yeah. And you've previously commented on your conviction that the status quo is changeable. And so when I look at my generation today, I don't really see that sentiment nearly enough. And I think, for example, previous decades like the 60s were more exemplary of young adults embracing their agency. And we seem to have maybe lost that a bit. So how would you think about instilling agency in the younger generation?
I'll tell you about the approach that I use when I worked for President Obama, and I still use to a certain extent, although I use slightly different language. And I would say, Leah, if you give me a good idea, I will set up a meeting with President Obama in the Oval Office, and he will say, if you explain to me why you're excited about your idea, why you think it's a good one, then I will call anyone on the planet. It can be a conference call, so there can be more than one person on the line. If it's someone inside the government, like the head of the National Institutes of Health, then I can direct them to do something because I'm their boss. If it's someone outside of the government, like a CEO or the head of a major university or foundation, then I can challenge them to do something. And what you have to tell me is not only what your idea is, but in order to make it happen, who would I call and what would I ask them to do? So the motivation for the thought experiment is that one of the perks of working for the president is you can send the president a decision memo and have him check the box that says yes. And if that happens enough times, then you begin to develop this really strong sense that there are more things in the world that are changeable as opposed to being fixed. But that in order to be able to exercise that sense of agency or to realize that, you have to figure out what is the coalition of the willing and able that you'd need to build. So unless it's the type of thing where you're saying, I want to write a book, right? That just requires enough discipline on your part to do the research and writing. But let's say you had some goal that you wouldn't be able to accomplish by yourself. Then you'd have to be able to articulate, what is the coalition of the willing and able that I would need to build in order to make that happen? And I think what people don't think about enough is that you can operate at multiple levels of indirection. So what do I mean by that? So as a private citizen, I'm not in a position to call the Secretary of Defense and say, sir, I really think you should do X for the following reasons. The gatekeepers around the Secretary of Defense are not going to allow him to have a call with a random citizen. So let's say that there's something I really want the Secretary of Defense to do. What I have to think about is who is in a position to ask him that question or suggest that idea, and how do I get to that person? So, for example, let's say that I decide someone who is on the Senate Armed Services Committee is the right person to ask the Secretary of Defense. Then I want to know, okay, on that issue, who is the legislative assistant that works for that senator? And do I know that legislative assistant, or does one of my friends know that assistant? And so now this is a straightforward chain of oral and written communication between me and the Secretary of Defense. It's just that I'm doing it at multiple levels of indirection. And so that seems a lot more doable to someone, right? To say, how do I find out using LinkedIn or some directory of congressional staff, who is the staff person who covers this issue for the senator who can write the letter to the Secretary of Defense?
Yeah, so bringing it down to the concrete. Now that seems very valuable. You've worked with a lot of different groups, so from scientists to engineers to staffers in the White House. How would you classify the key differences in the mental models of groups that you have worked with the most?
I would say, as a rule, scientists and engineers and entrepreneurs tend to be more optimistic and not in a, oh, things are definitely going to get better. But if we put our mind to it and mobilize the talent, we could make progress on this problem. So what I would call meliorism, which is not optimism and not pessimism, it's a sense that we could make things better than they are today, but it would need to be a conscious choice to do so, not to believe that it will just happen automatically. And I see maybe less of that among some of the political leaders, in part because of some of the reasons that we've identified, which is growing political polarization and gridlock, and a growing number of instances in which people say, if Biden is for it, then I must be against it, as opposed to saying, is there an area of common ground that we can find?
Yeah. And that actually reminds me of another question that I meant to ask, which is thinking about how your ideas might survive the next administration if you've worked on something for a long time under a president of one particular party, and your idea inherently has the potential to be a little more partisan. How can you perhaps de-partisanize, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, I think that there are a variety of different ways to do that. And I'll give you a couple of examples. So post 9/11, the one idea that became very prominent was that we had to do a better job of information sharing within the government between the intelligence community and law enforcement. And so people would say one part of the government knew this piece of information, another part knew this information, had this piece of information, and no one was connecting the dots. And the reason is that you have these stovepipes where different organizations have different authorities to collect different types of information. No one was collecting that information and integrating it. And the question was, how would you do that while maintaining privacy and civil liberties? And what happened was that there was a foundation, the Markle Foundation, that put together a task force of people outside government, but many of them, they had significant viewpoint diversity. So it wasn't just that they were like Democrats and Republicans. You had some people who had worked for the FBI and the intelligence community, and other people who were card-carrying members of the ACLU and really cared about privacy and civil liberties. And so the fact that you had people with a diversity of viewpoints and values that were able to come together and endorse a set of recommendations had a big influence, because congressional staffers could look at the report, they could look at who had signed the recommendations and what their background was and say, hey, it seems like there wouldn't be a lot of risk to my boss endorsing these recommendations because the national security, law enforcement, and privacy and civil liberties communities have all come together to endorse this set of recommendations. So I think that can be really valuable. And sometimes it's better that this occur outside of government, but that you have participants who are former policymakers and will represent the views of some of the key stakeholders that have an interest in a particular policy issue. So that's something that can make it a difference.
Got it. And do you think scientists could be coached in a relatively short amount of time to better communicate with industry policymakers or the public? Or are middlemen with lots of tacit knowledge always required? Could there be a Khalil masterclass in communications?
Well, there Alan Alda has been working on teaching scientists about how to do a better job of communicating the importance of their work. Going back to the Nanotechnology Initiative, I'll tell you a story about this. So one of the things that I did when I started working on this was to ask lots of researchers, if the president decided to make this a priority and we increased our investment in nanoscale science and engineering, what are some of the things that might come out of it? And they said things that were totally incomprehensible to a policy audience. We could have molecular electronics with a storage density of 10 to the 15 bits per cubic centimeter, materials with a Young's modulus of hundreds of gigapascals, and functionalized nano-engineered MRI contrast agents. And my job was to turn that into storing the Library of Congress in a device the size of a sugar cube, making materials that are stronger than steel in a fraction of the weight, and detecting cancerous tumors before they're visible to the human eye. So armed with those examples, which were all based on research that people were working on, so it wasn't like I just made these up, I was able to convince people who had primarily a legal or economics or congressional or campaign background, as opposed to material science and condensed matter physics background. So even that ability to explain the gist of a technical idea in ways that are accessible to policymakers is very valuable.
Yeah. You've previously described your work as being able to accelerate the rate at which information flows between different communities. So how do you think about the relevance of roles that shape the strength, direction, and the very existence of links in a network?
Yeah, so there's a whole field around the theory of social networks, and this field existed before social media. And one scholar whose name I believe is Ronald Burt talked about something called a structural hole. So that is, if you were to look at a graph of all of the social relationships, you would see these areas where there's very little connectivity. So in a high school setting, that might be there's these cliques like jocks and nerds, and very few of the jocks and nerds know each other and hang out. So that's a little bit about the sort of boundaries. So the point is that if you engage in boundary spanning between those areas where there's very little connectivity and very little flow of information, valuable things can come out of that. So let me give you an example. 1993, when I was working for President Clinton, I was one of, I would say, two staffers in the White House who was both working for President Clinton and hanging out with DARPA. And so one day they showed me what a mosaic looked like when it was connected to a high-speed network. And so there were several things that became immediately obvious to me. One is that this was going to allow people to be producers as well as consumers of information. So you know, the joke used to be, we have freedom of the press for everyone who is wealthy enough to afford a printing press. Well, in the future, everyone was going to be able to have their own printing press, their own radio station, their own TV station, number one. Number two, this was going to enable many-to-many communication as opposed to the one-to-many communication of traditional broadcast media. And number three, Mosaic was developed by an undergraduate whose name was Mark Andreessen. And so rather than the telecommunications network where we only got some new feature like call waiting or voicemail, when AT&T decided they were good and ready to give us voicemail and call waiting, some undergraduate could come up with a new application. And if it was popular and people wanted to use it, it could rapidly proliferate across the network. At the time, the conventional wisdom was that the internet was like this clunky academic plaything, and it would be replaced by something that industry was going to build called the information superhighway. And it was, and its primary focus was going to be on delivering 500 channels of video on demand. So that's what like the major cable and telecom companies were saying. But it was clear to me that, hey, like, you know, a lot of what they're talking, this information superhighway, what people want it to be able to do, the internet can just evolve to do those things because you can just run it over a faster and faster network. And it wasn't because I was technically brilliant. It was because DARPA had created a time machine to allow the research community to live in the future. And so anyone who wanted to like hang out with the research community and see what they were doing could see the world as it might exist 10 or more years in the future. What was sort of rare and expensive would eventually become affordable to anyone. And the ability to span those worlds, the worlds of computer networking and the technical community on the one hand and the policy community, has been one of the ways in which I've made a contribution to public policy.
Do you see an openness in the White House to bridge different sectors, or does it tend to perhaps tie it back to science, have a over-specialized element to it?
Yeah, I think that I don't want to just dunk on specialists. I think it's really important to have specialists because I think the thing that drives specialization, which is the production of huge amounts of knowledge and the difficulty of operating at the forefront of that, is important. But I also think that there's a role for people who, it's not like they know everything about everything, but maybe they know about two things. So for example, you're seeing the emergence of hybrid disciplines like computational biology, where someone knows some stuff about computer science and some stuff about biology. And maybe it's difficult for them to be simultaneously the very best biologist and the very best computer scientist, but they can play an important role to say, what are the tools that biology needs to be able to analyze and interpret the huge amounts of data being generated by genomics and proteomics and metabolomics and all the other omics?
Yeah. In your view, how much innovation is lost on government, and how do you capture more out-of-the-box innovative and individual contributions?
I think some of it is just giving them permission, giving people who work in the government permission. And within HHS, the Health and Human Services Agency, during the Obama administration, there were a series of chief technology officers that were recruited from outside of HHS. And one of the points they made is, hey, we have tens of thousands of people who work for HHS. And even if just 1% of them has an idea for making things better, that would be a lot of ideas. And they set up mechanisms by which if you were an HHS employee and you had an idea, you could submit it, number one, but rather than it being at like just a suggestion box that wasn't connected to the rest of the organization, you could get some time off to work on that. Maybe you could get a little bit of money. You could recruit someone who had specialized skills. You could get training in innovation methodologies like the Lean Startup or human-centered design. And so that was very effective in creating more of a culture of innovation and experimentation within the federal government. In terms of the ability of the federal government to harness ideas that exist outside, if you go to challenge.gov, you'll see instances of agencies using open innovation. So as I mentioned, I was able to get DARPA prize authority. And then when I came back into government in 2009, was able to work with the Senate to get every agency the ability to support incentive prizes for up to $50 million. And in that case, the government defines the problem, but then it's open to a really broad range of potential solutions from researchers, entrepreneurs, citizen inventors. I really believe an observation from Bill Joy, who was one of the founders of Sun Microsystems, and he said, no matter who you are, most of the smartest people work for someone else. And so as an organization like the federal government, you want to be telling the rest of the world what your problems are and having a mechanism for them to contribute to them.
So when you're trying to put a very promising idea into action and somewhat create a self-fulfilling prophecy by getting people excited, how do you think about getting the right people excited to work on it and collect them behind a mission?
Part of it is to ask the question, what is the initial coalition of the willing and able that would need to make this happen? So for example, I would ask people the question of what are the moonshots that we should be pursuing in the 21st century? And most people would just look at me blankly and say, that's a good question. But every once in a while, I would get a good answer. Mi-Young Chun, who worked for a foundation that supported both neuroscience and the physical sciences and engineering, had organized a workshop in the UK with some other foundations. And out of that grew the idea that eventually became the Brain Initiative. And the idea was the reason we don't fully understand how the brain encodes and processes information is that we're still limited by the tools that we have. We can measure the activity of a small number of neurons with really high levels of temporal and spatial resolution, or we can take a fuzzy picture of your entire brain, but we can't measure the real-time interaction of large-scale neural circuits. And so the workshop began to explore the question, what if we could? What if we had an initiative that tried to do for neuroscience what the development of high-throughput sequencing had done for genomics? And so she contacted me and said, there's this idea, the researchers are really excited about it. Could this be one of President Obama's moonshots? And I said, I'm not a neuroscientist, so I would have to talk to other neuroscientists, but it seems like it's important enough for the president to be personally involved in it. So as I started to think about that idea, my view was that there were three people in the government who, if they all said yes, then it would have critical mass and credibility. And those three people were the heads of NIH, NSF, and DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency. So to make a long story short, they all said yes, president said yes, and Congress said yes. So part of it depends on not like who's everyone could participate, because that might be like a very long list. But is there an 80-20 rule at work here where if there are like three organizations that if they all said yes, then people would say, oh, wow, I'd like to get involved too. And that's what happened. Like other agencies contacted me and said, what about me? I want to get involved too. And I was like, great. But I didn't like it. It's one way to put this is if you're trying to get done, you don't start with a UN General Assembly. You say, is there a smaller group of people and organizations where if they got behind it, it would have credibility and critical mass?
Makes sense. What's the most important or concealed counterintuitive thing that you've learned during your career about human nature?
About human nature? Oh my goodness. Yeah. I always look for people who are intrinsically motivated. I think that is, it's still underrated, but I think that, so rather than me thinking, what are the set of carrots and sticks that I can use to get Leah to do what I want her to? It's, what does Leah want to do? And how can I enable Leah to do that? So that's one thing about human nature that I think is really important.
Yeah. And what have you learned about failure during your career?
One of the things I struggle with is I'm interested in a lot of different things. So if someone comes to me and said, all right, Tom, for the next 4 years, you only get to work on one thing, and what would that be? That's like a very uncomfortable choice for me to make. But what that leads to as sort of a failure mode for me is to devote enough time to an issue, to have a certain understanding of what the challenges and opportunities, maybe sort of initial hypothesis about what I would like to see happen, some initial conversations to try to build that coalition of the willing and able that I was talking about, but not enough time to really push it over the finish line. Because I like to tell people, it's not the first meeting, it's the fifth meeting. So a lot of times you'll have some discussion with someone and they'll say, yeah, that's interesting. You know, we should have a follow-up conversation. And then if they never hear from you again, their view is it must not have been that important. Or I had this whiteboard in the White House where we had these sort of aphorisms that were related to getting things done. And one was, people never follow up. And I don't literally mean that. So I don't mean it's never the case that people follow up. But a good fraction of the time, you'll meet someone and you say, we should have coffee. Or you'll have a conversation with someone and they'll say, that's a really good idea. I think the next step is for me to write a two-pager on this issue. And then they just don't, right? People are busy. They've got lots of things going on. And so if you want to get something done, you have to both hold yourself accountable and you have to, in a, you know, pleasant way, but a persistent way, try to hold other people accountable as well, right? So there's a set of techniques for doing that. And one of them is to try to make a commitment that someone makes more specific. So if I want someone to do something and they say, the next step for me is to do X, then I could say, great. When do you think it would make sense for us to connect again? Should we get together in a month? Would that, given your other obligations, would that give you enough time to do whatever it is that you promised to do? And it's just very easy to just let something lapse. Two people have made commitments to each other, but they're all also hopelessly overcommitted. Person A doesn't follow up and person B is not reminding them that they promised to do that and try to get it on the sort of near the top of their priority.
Yeah. So I'm curious, are you still uncomfortable to make these commitments for 4 years at a time working on a project? Have you thought through or think differently now about how to commit to things or what to commit to at all? What's your judgment after decades of work experience?
I would say what I am generally trying to do is to serve as a force multiplier for an individual or community. So rather than saying, I am going to do this, it's more, I have found someone in the world, or I found a community or an organization or a group of organizations who wants to get X done. And I believe that there's some value that I can add. And maybe it's just giving them advice. Maybe it's being an advocate for their idea. Maybe it's helping them mobilize resources. Maybe it's helping them get permission or growing the size of the coalition of the people who are and organizations that are supporting the idea, but there's some concrete thing that I can do. So I think that's what I tend to do as opposed to saying, I by myself am going to do X and therefore devote all my time to it. I'm just looking for people who have an idea that I think is important if true, and there's some role that I can play in increasing the chances that it will happen.
What's something nobody will tell me that I should know? What's something you discovered in your life that society or employers or friends conceal that is important to know? And it doesn't have to be willfully hidden, but just something that is somewhat implicit and kept on a subconscious level.
I think one of the things I discovered is that there is a trade-off that you can make if you're willing to do this between getting things done and claiming the credit. So this is actually one of the things in my White House whiteboard, which is you can get more done if you don't care who gets the credit. Because sometimes there will be people who really care about who gets the credit. And in that situation, you might be more likely to be successful if that's a trade-off that you're willing to make.
Got it. What have you become more skeptical about in the past 10 years? And what have you become more confident or convinced of?
I think in general, I believe that there are a lot of things that take longer than people think that they do. For example, when I first started working for President Clinton, my 29-year-old self was pretty convinced that technology was going to transform the way teachers teach and students learn. And if you think about how the internet was used during the pandemic, to a large extent, it was a teacher giving a lecture on Zoom. And that's not why I worked on educational technology. That's not like I was like, oh, I want to work on educational technology so that someday if you're stuck at home, you can watch a professor or a teacher give a lecture online. And I think the sort of genuine transformation of a field can take a lot longer than people think that it will. So yeah. One futurist, Paul Sappho, likes to say, never mistake a clear view for a short distance.
So lastly, what don't I know that I don't know? What important questions have I not asked of you today?
I think you've done an excellent job of asking probing and insightful questions.
Well, Tom, thank you so much. We'll link to more of your work below, and I really appreciate you taking the time today.
Sure. Take care.